I've been reading books on how to force kids to ask their own questions and not me say, well, just ask a good question, because that never generates any questions. And so I'm trying to figure out strategies where, because I've always thought good questions were far more important than good answers, because, you know, good questions lead you to different avenues, whereas just telling people the facts, you know, it's kind of boring. So I like penetrating questions.
Welcome to the fourth episode of the Forensic Anthropology Companion Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Kennyhurst. Today, I am joined by Drs. G. Richard Scott and Marin Palud to discuss their RASUDAS application and its corresponding article, RASUDAS, a new web-based application for estimating ancestry from tooth morphology, which was co-authored with David Nevega, Joao Coelho, Eugenia Cunha, and Joel Irish, who also happened to be my PhD advisor and taught me the importance of broad brushstrokes, which makes its way into the following chat. That clip at the beginning is Dr. G. Richard Scott, and that was how he answered my call for this interview. I've known Richard for quite some time, and I've always admired him not only for his extensive research profile, but also this exact sentiment, a consummate curiosity. I wanted to start this episode with that quote because I feel like it encapsulates the spirit and intent of this podcast, and is something I am personally obsessed with, how to ask a good question.
Could you please explain how this developed from the conception of the ASU Dental Anthropology System through its development into this application of RASUDAS?
So you want me to go all the way back to developing the plaques?
I'm willing to go back as far as you're willing to go back.
Well, I'll tell you about a couple of things that I got involved in as a graduate student, because at that time, dental morphology had a pretty bad name, because people were always complaining that people could not replicate the observations of others. And it really was not all that useful back in the day. But Christie, taking his cue from Dahlberg, started expanding upon the Dahlberg plaques. He started off with cusp 6 and cusp 7, and I actually made all those plaques, and then we distributed them throughout the world. And then I looked at what had been done, and so I noticed that one thing nobody had ever touched upon much was the canine. So I started developing classifications for canine traits. And so that's when I did the canine distal accessory ridge and the canine tubercle. And this was one thing I also thought was very important, was to take the Herdlitzka-Dahlberg shoveling classification and make sense of it, because the distribution of that was absolutely nuts in American Indians, where Mark Shoveling, you know, it just went up a scale, and Mark Shoveling was like 70 or 80%. And when I laid it out on a seven-grade scale, all of a sudden, the variation was normally distributed. So I won't go any more into the plaques on that. But obviously, over the next 20 years, Christie used them to great effect in studying the peopling of the New World and the dichotomy in Asia, the peopling of the Pacific. And then finally, in 1991, Christie formalized it in that article that laid out the classifications for like 38 traits. Okay, so now I'm going to jump ahead a little bit to show you how the foundation was laid. In 1992, Gabriel Lasker asked me if I thought I was ready to write a book on dental morphology. And that was actually triggered by sending him a couple of articles that I'd done, you know, just as a courtesy, because he was a seminal player in the early foundations of dental anthropology. And so he was an editor-in-chief at the Cambridge series. And so I thought, I'll do it, but I've got to involve Christie. So I spent a sabbatical leave in Arizona in 92, 93, and then I ended up writing it after I returned to Fairbanks, but the Anthropology of Modern Human Teeth came out the same month that I retired from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And the only reason I'm leading up to that is, after doing the Anthropology of Modern Human Teeth, you've seen all the box whisker plots in there showing variation around the world. And in the last paragraph of the book, what I basically say is you should read the last paragraph sometime because it's prescient in some ways, but it shows my limitations in other ways, because I say, you know, given the tremendous amount of variation in dental morphological traits among world populations, that at some point in time, you know, not only will we be able to evaluate population similarities and differences, but we should be able to use dental morphology to actually identify individuals using some advanced form of mathematics like discriminant function, Bayes theorem, or neural networks. I said we ran out of time, so I didn't do it. But what I didn't say is I didn't have the abilities to really come up with the kind of algorithm needed to do that. So in 2015, I was invited by Ana Maria Silva to be a Fulbright specialist at the University of Coimbra. And so it was a 2-week gig, and I went there and I gave all kinds of workshops. I even gave a workshop on dental modification. But the last workshop was a full day number on dental morphology. I think I did the maxillary dentition in the morning and the mandibular dentition in the afternoon. And there were probably 30 or 40 people. It was a big group. And I had a great time. I love those people in Portugal. I have many friends in Portugal now. But this is the bottom line. At the end of that full-day session on dental morphology, David Navega and João Coella came up to me and said, "Professor, we have developed an application where you can estimate the ancestry of an individual from dental morphology." And I thought, what? And they showed me, and I fell out of my chair. Basically, what they had done, they took the frequencies that were in the appendix of the book and all of the geographic subdivisions in the book, and they used that to develop the original version of RASUDAS. I mean, I was so excited that I said, "Hey, listen, let's keep this going." So I went home and I took 150 data sheets from, I'd copied all of Christy Turner's data sheets in 2013 and 2014. So I found 150 data sheets and then I sent them to those guys. I took off the geography and then they ran them through the application. This was what was leading up to the article, but there was one more thing too. You left out some traits and you included some that you probably shouldn't include. So they did modify it and came up with a beta version. And the beta version, because some of the traits have such a wide range of variation, it didn't seem like all or none was the best way to go, like zero or present. And so for shoveling, Carabelli's trait, the hypocone, and the protostylid, we broke it down into three states, which, you know, I thought would be a more accurate way to get at ancestry. And I will reserve this for a little bit later, but I just got the latest version 2 days ago, and it is so exciting.
I love this because this shows a lot of, I think, really important themes that come up in dental anthropology a lot. The first of which you talked about is conceptually that importance of standardization, right? We had the Wild West of people just making their own classification schema and applying them to things in unstandardized way, and no one could really replicate it. And it wasn't that there wasn't any morphological variation that was useful in the dentition, is that people just couldn't agree on how to look at it or what was useful yet. And then came the development of the plaques, right? The standardization in which we can now encapsulate this entire range of variation in a very consistent way. But it also shows, I mean, those plaques went everywhere, right? Every single institution I've ever been at, I remember seeing those plaques somewhere at some point. And I think collaboration is another big aspect of dental anthropology for the reasons that you've pointed out. Dental anthropologists have worked with frequency data for so long that you can take other people's data and compare it to your own in a meaningful way and make those kinds of like one-to-one comparisons, something that is lacking in other disciplines, particularly ones that use very similar ordinal scaled things. They just don't take that extra step. But then you have these people that can take that frequency data as opposed to just using it to contextualize their own paper and create this product with it. I think all of these ideas encompass all of kind of the way dental anthropology has been structured and taught and the way that dental anthropologists think about it.
Could I throw in one thing there?
Please, yeah.
When I wrote the book, you know, I summarized the literature for, I don't know, the past 80 years and put it in tables. And what I discovered in looking at papers written before 1991 and those written after 1991, there was an incredible difference. As soon as, you know, Christie laid out the classification for ASUDAS, I looked at papers from India, from Finland, from all parts of Europe. And then, of course, Joel. I was at Joel's dissertation defense in 1993. You know, Joel obviously has used the system extensively, and his data I trust completely. The data after 1991 took a quantum leap above the data before that date. And now I think people really know what they're doing. And that's why I'm optimistic that ultimately, people with a little bit of training, and Marin and I have both done workshops on this, with a little bit of training, will be able to apply the RASUDAS to their own particular cases.
Even after 1991, just the breadth and depth and just coverage that studies took, right? It was this little of explosions of applying this in different places and being able to compare these results to things we knew about from other places. Marin, from your perspective, because I knew you, brother, when I was an undergraduate, you were finishing your PhD at Ohio State. So from your perspective, how have you seen this development from kind of your point of view when you started your PhD to where we are now?
That is a huge question. I'm going to go all the way back. So when I was in the fourth grade, I had to write a book and I said that I wanted to be an archaeologist. That was the about the author. I started as an archaeologist. My undergrad was completely focused on archaeology. And then I worked as a contract archaeologist in the Bay Area for 3 or 4 years. And that was really when I started to see the value of teeth as a tool for answering research questions. Every project that I worked on during that time happened to be a burial project or a cemetery excavation. So I got a lot of practical experience with excavation and then worked on the analysis, even though I didn't have very much undergraduate training in doing any of that sort of work. They trusted me for some reason to do it. Most of the data that we were collecting as part of the repatriation really just seemed focused on the teeth. So looking at the pathological conditions, wear, stress indicators, morphology, size, all of those could answer so many questions that we had. And they were always in better shape than the rest of the skeletal remains. So I kind of pushed archaeology as a main focus to the side and went to Ohio State to do bioarchaeology. I started off just being a really general bioarchaeologist, and then as you do, you become a little more specialized. So my training in dental anthropology is pretty broad, and I really should thank Debbie Vitelli-Steinberg for her help in getting me there. I was fortunate enough to also work as a graduate student with Simon Hilson in the field. And then, of course, I mean, Clark gave me all of these opportunities and taught me a long way. But I was coming at it from a bioarchaeology viewpoint. I didn't do any forensic anthropology until after I finished my PhD. And I was surprised when I started at the DPA that was called JPAC when I worked there. I was surprised that teeth weren't regularly used for that much, really just for age estimation. Because for me, it seemed like such an important tool for analytical questions and research and hypothesis formulation. So I guess now I'm full circle. That is how I kind of came into it. And it's been several years at the DPAA and kind of learning how forensic anthropologists work, how they view their research and their analysis, and being able to do all that applied work to see how dental morphology and metrics, which I think is very important, but maybe Richard doesn't think it's as important.
I was going to throw one thing in about metrics and morphology. Christie always used to joke that wherever he went, C. Loring Brace had either been there or he was on his way. So I have no idea where Brace's odontometric data ended up. But there would probably be an enormous amount of analysis that could be done if you could merge those two. Because, I mean, Brace, he knew how to measure teeth. He never screwed around with morphology at all. And Christie didn't know the end of a caliper, which end would measure.
What are three important takeaways that you think people should get from this paper? And that can be in terms of the way it's presented, the way the research was done, the way you think research should be done and this shows it, or the way that you think this tool should be used in practice.
Well, initially, I thought it was fairly straightforward that, we were doing something that had never been done, let's say, efficiently, because all the other attempts to use dental morphology and ancestry estimation were either traitless kinds of things, or they were very limited in terms of the populations they were applied to. And that was the advantage that this method had, plus its ease of use. And so initially it was conceived basically as a forensic application to identify the ancestry of individuals. But one spinoff of that, which I have been putting to good use and others have as well, is using it in bioarchaeological contexts. Because maybe I'll tell you guys in a little bit, because I've been playing around with the new application and applying it to Kamakura Japanese individuals. And I've gotten some really, really cool results. And I'm so excited about this new, the modifications that have been made to the new application. So it all kind of revolves around ancestry one way or another. So we're doing a big project on the Beringian standstill, but also on more specifically the notion that John Erlandson has put out that the Japanese populations may have played a role in the peopling of the New World. And so based on teeth, that is seems very unlikely to me. And so I'm analyzing both frequencies and individuals to kind of flesh that out. So Marin, you get to put in the third.
Yeah. So I actually spent the morning like writing out answers to all these questions that you gave us. So I have three. Well, there's actually four because I have the basic idea of the paper. So one is teeth show pattern variation due to population history and then evolutionary past and evolutionary processes. Dental morphology can be used to answer a wide range of anthropological questions. And this one I think is important too, is that there's really no single answer when looking at human variation. It shouldn't just be craniometrics. It shouldn't just be macromorphoscopics. It shouldn't just be dental morphology. It's really moving forward, putting those things together. And so we focused on dental morphology in the paper because it hasn't been a big area of focus in the past. So this is highlighting that, hey, there's another way we can study human variation. And it's steeped in evolution, migration, population history, and that helps us interpret what we're seeing with the data.
So this was touched a little bit in your last response, but what is an aspect of this research that you think is important that might get missed?
It ties into the last one a little bit, and it ties into what I think is the main point of the paper, but I think could get lost in some of it, and that is the importance of evolution and population history, but also the idea that methods for ancestry estimation are imperfect and that it requires more nuanced interpretation that does incorporate these things that we talk about in the paper. You need to understand heritabilities. You need to understand how evolution shaped the traits that you're looking at, either through selection or drift or flow. All of that needs to be incorporated. There's a lot of overlap in the populations that we're defining as populations. So uncertainty in these estimations is inevitable, and we shouldn't try to push the models to do more than they really can do. You just have to really think about it anthropologically and not just in an applied way.
And I think that's interesting too about this approach in general, but I think that requires a perspective shift on the practitioner side. For as much as forensic anthropology talks about stepping away from being typologists, the way we use these tools is completely a typological mindset. Just because I get a four-disc result does not tell me anything unique other than the mathematics dictated this.
And I get that when you are writing a report, you need to have an answer and you need to support that answer statistically. A lot of this has to do with method development and in interpretation of the result. And that's part of just creating a method that can be used broadly. And if we can't do that, we can't do that, but we need to think more critically about how we're studying modern human variation and what traits we're using and how we're looking at them statistically and then how they're being used broadly in society, which could be problematic. But anyway, that's for another discussion.
One thing that just came up from my analysis of the first 8 Kamakura Japanese, they didn't all come out of East Asia, but Western Eurasia and Africa never reared their heads. So I'll give you an example. Like the first individual was American Arctic East Asia, the second East Asia, Southeast Asia, third American Arctic East Asia, then Southeast Asia, East Asia, then East Asia, American Indian, Southeast Asia. I mean, it was true in every case. Never once did Africa or Western Eurasia pop up above 0.1. And they were usually like 0.008. So, you know, when you're talking about Asian populations, you're talking about a very distinct set of morphology, but based on an individual, it's sometimes hard to determine if it's inclined more towards Southeast Asia or the New World, because it's far more subtle.
Yeah, and that's like the appropriateness of the census scale, right? So if you ran some sort of discriminant model looking at just kind of continental groups, and you looked at what was driving the variation, and if I'll just use a craniometric sense because that's what I've been working on recently, you're going to see that if you just use like a basic length and breadth measurement, you're going to separate the continental groups very well. But again, that's a very blunt, broad way to describe kind of like morpho groups or just continental groups. But that makes sense because that follows this idea of spatial autocorrelation, and that we're going to have this kind of cline of inheritance of these traits if we do believe that craniometrics have some sort of genetic component to them. We can see that, but then if we zoom in and we look at the kind of regional scale at here, we start seeing, one, a lot of overlap, but two, much finer grain differences that were not encapsulated or shown priority in the initial model, solely because our sense of scale has changed and the things that are driving variation at different levels of scale should change with it. So looking back, what would you have done differently originally, or I guess since this is a retrospective, since this has been a few years since it's been published, this could just be an opportunity like what you've done since then, what you've learned along the way and where it's going.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what we've done and Marin can tell you what we should do next. Okay, in terms of what we've done, I knew one of the problems, like the naive-Bayes theorem algorithm that David developed, it's based on trait independence. And so you can't use shovel-shaped central incisors and shovel-shaped lateral incisors. So you have to just use one of those. But it was my thought, especially since I've got thousands of these data sheets from Christy Turner. And in some cases, an individual has the lateral incisor, but doesn't have the central. So this latest application that David has developed is based on some new frequencies that I provided for several. These are what we call backup traits. So now on the new application, there is a thing for UI1 shoveling. And if the individual has UI1 shoveling, then you skip UI2 shoveling. But if there are no central incisors scored and the laterals are scored, then you can plug those in. Now, those are based on totally different frequencies. You know, their correlation is not 1.0. Their correlation is more like 0.5. And so they have different frequencies in all these populations. And I have all that data. Okay, so we did it for shoveling. We did it for the metaconial or cusp 5 of the upper molars. We did it for enamel extensions, UM1. And if you don't have UM1, you go to LM1. We have it for cusp 6. If you don't have it for LM1, you go to LM2, where it's less common, but it is still much more common in Asian populations than it is in Europeans and Africans. And I think a lingual cusp number of the premolars, right? Originally, we had LP2, but if LP2 is missing, LP1 can be used. Oh, there's one more, 4 cusps lower second molars. That's one of the traits. But if there is no second molar, you can use 4 cusps LM1 if it's present. And that helps discriminate European populations because the trait list is fairly Asia-centric because a lot of early pioneers in dental anthropology focused on Asians. So we're trying to get in as many traits that characterize other populations as possible. Okay, so we have these backup traits. In addition to those backup traits, we have now added tuberculum dentale. Tuberculum dentale, the canine, is the primary. And if we don't have that, we have tuberculum dentale of the central incisor. So that's a new trait. We're also now going back to the Bushman canine, which was taken out of the Ada version. And we're also doing lower canine distal accessory ridge. So we have added 3 or 4 new traits, and we have backups for like 5 or 6 traits. This was something that I figured had to be done. You have to have as many traits scored as possible. So that was one way to do it. Marin can tell you about what I'm sure she would love to see on this as soon as we have data for all of these groups. Go ahead, Maren. It's all up to you.
Okay, so moving forward with this project, we have collected a lot more data, as I already mentioned. So we've collected data from populations, and we've been to South Africa and throughout the United States looking at morphology and metrics of the dentition. So as I said, Richard is doing the morphology, I'm doing the metrics, and also incorporating not only maximum crown dimensions, but also cervical dimensions of the tooth. We're still collecting more data, and we're also adding some new traits, including molar crenulations, dental crowding. I'm still looking into, we're doing some work now on looking at midline and canine diastema. So midline diastema has been around for a while, but looking at the canine diastema might be helpful. I'm playing with some of that data right now. So in the future, yeah, incorporate, seeing if any of these new traits have better discriminatory power, adding metrics, adding modern reference samples. And then one thing that I do think is going to be really important as we move forward too, in addition to, you know, bigger reference samples, bigger data sets, is really looking at observer error, because some of the traits have a lot of observer error and that could introduce error into the models. So I think that the trichotomized traits will help with some of that. So we're looking at that right now too, is where the breakpoints are and how that affects error and how it affects how the models work. And some traits might just have way too much observer error that make them maybe not super helpful, especially if this is going to be used by lots and lots of different people in different ways. We need to make sure that the traits can be reported accurately. What else are we doing? Oh, yeah, potato tooth. We do have the potato tooth.
I don't think the potato tooth is discriminating enough, but we're collecting data on it.
Yeah, I forgot to plug potato tooth. We're looking at that, though, too. Data have been collected on the potato tooth.
Can you just describe what a potato tooth is for anybody that might be wondering?
Yeah, you know, the funny thing, Mike, about the potato tooth is I have seen these for 4 decades, but it's typically the second molar, sometimes the third. I just call them anterior posterior compression because they're kind of squeezed together. But now that I've looked at it a lot more, basically what you get is a hypertrophied pericone and hypocone and a convergence of the protocone and the metacone. And so our PhD students, when we're looking at this, I think the girl from Idaho said, "That looks like a potato." So that's where it got its name, and it does look like a freaking potato. But typically, there's a really distinctive large crest between the protocone and the metacone. And so we're going to standardize this, and we'll have lots of illustrations. But what really got me excited about this, Mike, is that I brought back photographs of 300 twin dentitions from Australia. And we found this one pair of monozygotic twins that had absolutely identical potato teeth. I mean, they are absolutely identical. Yeah, I always thought it was kind of a spacing problem. The tooth germ was somehow compressed by crowding or something. But you see some really screwed up third molars. And I think that may reflect a lot of environmental factors during development.
How should people use this in their practice?
I do think that our ASUDAS could be incorporated in casework with a caveat, I guess. And that is, we still need to validate it on modern samples to best understand if secular change is playing a large role. The data so far suggests that secular change is low. I know Richard has done work on this, and there's not a huge amount of change in morphological variation over large amounts of time. But I guess also with any ancestry estimation technique, it should not be the only thing that you look at. If you only have teeth and this is all you're going to do, you need to account for that uncertainty in your final case report. And then there are other tools such as tooth size that you could look at, other things that you could bring into this understanding of human variation. Final plug that we've already talked about, that we are updating this with modern samples. And so as we wrote in the article, kind of the hope or kind of the end goal is that some of the Turner data could be kind of used as a Howell sort of reference sample, and that the modern sample could be used more for casework. And then once we have done more of these analyses that we need to do, we can better understand sort of the secular change and how that's being incorporated.
We have applied it to a lot of dental casts, and lacking roots, it still works pretty darn good. One really incredible thing about this is that I have it on my phone. I mean, you could use it in the field so easily. It is so user-friendly. It is free. When David Navega presented this to me, I said, oh my God, you're going to make a lot of money. And he said, Professor, I want it to be freeware. So everybody can thank David Navega for being a very humble soul. In that article, it has the web address that anybody can download for nothing.
Are there any types of studies that students could use or do that would be helpful to your overall goal and vision of this program that would be beneficial? You know, so like you're obviously going to be feeding your own students, kind of like the chariest ones, but what are some things that people could be doing that might be helpful for you? Not only like, this isn't stimulate research to help other people too. This can be like stimulate research that directly helps you guys.
Christine, I used to bemoan the fact that once the system was developed, no one was developing new traits. You know, you'd have to be in a certain circumstance. At ASU, we had dental casts from many parts of the world. And so I could look at Solomon Islanders or Bantu or Bushmen or Native Americans or Easter Islanders. We didn't have any Australians, Chinese. And so when coming up with new traits, you know, you really have to look at a lot of casts. Basically, Chris Stojanowski even told me one time, he said, is ASUDAS sat in cement? Is that all it's going to be? And I said, God, no. We would love for people to develop new traits. I mean, Dahlberg, you know, some people adopted the 56 Dahlberg plaques, but Christy wasn't happy with that. And then he developed new traits, and I developed a lot of new traits. And then by 1991, it was published, and then people said, well, I guess that's it. But it's not. I have told more than one student, you know, I go to a lot of international meetings, and whenever I have a chance, I put in a plug for the premolars. I tell people that, you know, upper and lower molars, they've been hit pretty hard, but the premolars show a lot of complex variation. And I think they could be tapped for at least 6 or 8 new traits. Krauss and Fern Ludwig, you know, back in the 50s, had these trait classifications, but most of those weren't all that good. And they weren't all that applicable. But there are some things that I think if they were systematically observed, they could be very useful. So
I want to talk about the discussion of the misclassification between Southeast Asian and Polynesian groups, just because I think this is a really good example of using theory to contextualize your results. If you could contextualize this or couch this as it relates to the concepts of synodonty versus pseudodonty and the Beringian standstill model.
Okay, the thing about Southeast Asians and Polynesians, if you look through the box whisker plots of either the first or second edition of the Anthropology of Modern Human Teeth, one thing you will note is the Southeast Asians, or the what we call the Sunda-Pacific groups, are not extreme for any trait, not a single trait. They're always in the middle. And oftentimes they're kind of in the middle. Well, you're Africa. They're closer to one another than they are to Asia. And this is why Christy Turner thought Southeast Asia was the homeland of modern Homo sapiens, because he thought you could derive everybody from Southeast Asians. It's not exactly like I agree with him on that, but that was in the last chapter of the first edition. Now, since I had more control in the second edition, I did not include that because I still don't believe it. And I don't know if you ever read C.L. Brace's review of the first edition, but that was the only thing he really complained about, was getting everybody out of Southeast Asia, out of the Sundadons. But I kind of understand what Christy was getting at. But the Sundadons, basically, they have a lot of the Sundadon characteristics, but in a more muted form. It's like they have 3 rooted lower first molars, but in a lower frequency. Like they're typically around 10 or 12%, and we've known that for a long time. Shoveling is definitely not as pronounced in Sundadons. it averages a grade lower than you see in cynodonts. For some traits, they're pretty darn similar. They both have incredibly high frequencies of Cas6, but they differ for cynodonts have much more root fusion than pseudodonts. But when you plug them in, they literally are the muddle in the middle. Pseudodonts, you know, they might have grade 3 shoveling and then a grade 7 Carabelli's trait and a 4 cusp lower second molar. They just show such a diverse mix of traits that are not easily classified. Now, Sahul Pacific, the Australomelanesians, they're a little bit like that, but they have at least one trait that is an extreme on a world scale. That's cusp 5. But New Guinea and Australia, their frequencies of cusp 5 are over 60%. And that is way, way beyond anybody else. I was telling somebody, I've looked at Australians and New Guinea. They're really weird in and of themselves. But in Australians, I can see a hint of Asia. And when I say that, I see some odontomes. I see some shoveling, I see some three-rooted lower first molars, but never as high as you see in Asians. But in New Guinea, you don't see that. And we published a couple of papers on New Guinea. They're really weird.
Are there any final thoughts? Anything you want to put out into the world that would make your lives better or would help you out?
I'll plug this. If you're interested in teeth, you can join the Dental Anthropology Association. You can check us out at dentalanthropology.org. There's a journal. They have a flagship journal that's also called Dental Anthropology that I edit, and people can submit papers there. Richard and I love to talk about teeth. So we're happy to talk to anybody about any research project. We're pretty open to collaboration and discussion and data sharing and all of that.
Thank you to Dr. Scott and Palud for taking the time to sit down and talk teeth with me. You can access the RASUDAS program at osteomics.com, and we've put a link in the episode description as well. We'll be back in a few weeks with more interviews. If you would like to get involved and talk research with other folks in the field, or if you have any ideas for special episodes you'd like to hear, please reach out to us on all social media at JForensicAnth. Thanks for listening.